give the appearance of a periodic effect. The second, more speculative but far more interesting option, is that the structure of the galaxy is different from what is commonly assumed, in which case the tidal effect could be bigger and more dramatically varying than anticipated. This was the path we decided to explore, and it paid off. As the next part of the book explains, when Matt and I accounted for what is known about the density of ordinary matter in the Milky Way plane and the measured position and velocity of the Sun, we found that agreement with the crater record fared better when confronted with our proposed dark matter model. A dark matter disk in the usual Milky Way plane with the appropriate density and thickness could adjust the predicted magnitude and time dependence of the galactic plane's tidal force so that both the impact period and the trigger pulse match the data reasonably well. As a nice bonus, in this way of thinking, the look elsewhere effect of the previous chapter is less compromising than previously thought. We no longer have to think about all possible periods, but only those that take account of the measured ordinary matter density in the galaxy. Armed with the admittedly imprecise measurements of the solar system and a suitable model of the dark matter disk, we can restrict the range of possible oscillation periods to be only those predictions consistent with existing Milky Way disk density measurements. Matt and I found that with existing data taken into account, the periodic assumption had roughly 3 times the likelihood of random hits. Though not strong enough statistical evidence to establish the existence of the dark matter disk that we had proposed, the result was promising enough to merit further study. The best part of this approach is that our knowledge of the galaxy's gravitational potential will continue to improve. Our method, which takes account of all the available information about the galaxy, will become increasingly reliable as more accurate data about the galaxy and the Sun's motion is collected. Scientists today are measuring the distribution of matter in the galaxy. Current satellite observations are recording the positions and velocities of stars, helping us to infer the gravitational potential they experience, namely, the potential that binds them to the Milky Way. This, in turn, will tell us more about the structure of the galactic plane. In what promises to be some truly exciting results, theory and measurements will tie together solar system motion with data here on Earth. More data in the future will lead to more reliable predictions, making for yet more trustworthy results. The next part of the book returns to dark matter models and closes with the particular model that might explain periodicity in the crater record. The study of periodicity and the Earth's history is an excellent justification to explore both our immediate visible vicinity and the more ethereal world of dark matter, allowing us to consider the remarkable possibilities for what might be out there and visibly populating our universe. Part 3. Deciphering Dark Matter's Identity. Chapter 16. The Matter of the Invisible World. The past century's theoretical and observational advances in astronomy, physics, and cosmology have taught us an incredible amount. But the universe contains a great deal that we have never seen and likely never will. Various factors account for our limited vision. Many objects are simply too distant to observe. Something very far away won't necessarily emit or scatter enough light to be identified, since any light it did send out would become too widely dispersed and dim. On top of that, dust or celestial bodies might block our line of sight or obscure our view. Though space probes in distant regions of the cosmos do help surmount these obstacles, no probe has made it to the nearest star, never mind to the nearest galaxy. With their restricted reach and only imperfect resolution, direct probes provide only limited access at best. Still more factors restrict what we might see. Even if it's in our immediate vicinity, something can be too small to notice. Our visual processing constrains what we can detect without intervening technology. Because we see with visible wavelengths, anything smaller than the wavelength of visible light is beyond our ability to detect with the naked eye. With the latest advances, the Large Hadron Collider in Geneva is the state of the art, we can observe physical processes at smaller sizes than ever before. But even that enormous machine exposes matter down to only about 1/10,000,000th of a trillionth of a meter. Without further technological progress, sizes and forces relevant to still tinier distances will remain beyond our observational capacity. But with dark matter, we have an even more airtight excuse not to have seen it. Dark matter doesn't emit or absorb light, which is, let's face it, essential for human vision. Dark matter interacts via gravity, but as far as we can tell, in no other discernible fashion. We know of its existence for reasons explained in Chapter 2, and we know some gross features of its properties, but we don't yet know precisely what dark matter actually is. This is what makes it such a compelling subject for research. In anticipation of our ultimate goal of tying together dark matter and comets, let's now return from the study of the solar system to the subject of dark matter, and consider some of the leading possibilities for what dark matter might be. Model building. Although we are confident it's out there, we don't yet know what dark matter actually is. We know dark matter's average energy density in the cosmos, from the microwave background, its density nearby, from the rotation velocities of stars in the galaxy, that it is cold, which is to say, it moves at only a fraction of the speed of light, because we observe structure on small scales in the cosmos, that it interacts at most extremely weakly, both with ordinary matter and with itself, from the lack of discovery in direct searches, and from measurements, such as that of the shape of the bullet cluster, and that it doesn't carry electric charge. But that's about it. Even if dark matter consists of an elementary particle, we don't know its mass, if it has any non-gravitational interactions, or how it was created in the early universe. We know its average density, but we don't yet know if there is one proton mass per cubic centimeter in our galaxy, or 1,000 trillion times the proton mass that is distributed throughout the universe much more diffusely, say every kilometer cubed. Small numerous objects and heavier, more dilute ones can both give the same average dark matter density, which is all that astronomers have measured. Most physicists would bet that dark matter is composed of a new elementary particle that doesn't have the usual standard model interactions. Knowing what the particle is means knowing its mass and its interactions, and if it is perhaps part of some larger sector of new particles. Many physicists have their favorite candidates, but I won't rule out any suggestion until observations beat me to it. Fortunately for making progress towards pinpointing the nature of dark matter, one less obdurate reason plays a role in our limited vision. Sheer obliviousness or lack of attention can keep things hidden, even those that we might with current technology have the capacity to observe. Very often we fail to see things that we didn't expect. When I sat in the lunchroom on the set of The Big Bang Theory, the popular TV show with physicists as lead characters, only a few viewers noticed my presence. I could barely do so myself, even though I appeared very near the lead character, fully within the frame of the TV. You can see for yourself in the photo in Figure 35 on the enhanced portion of this audiobook. However, obliviousness is something we can correct for. Whereas magicians take advantage of this weakness, scientists try to overcome it. Our goal is to identify what we might be missing for lack of attention. Model builders like me try to imagine what might be out there that experimenters haven't yet looked for or realized could be within their grasp. In our models, we make guesses for what might underlie and explain the phenomena that we know. With specific models in mind, experimenters can target their searches and data analyses to confirm or rule out any definite suggestions. Even very elusive matter might thereby come into view. I'm often asked about the criteria I apply when trying to construct a particle physics model. Certainly, any good model should be rooted in sound physical ideas that might extend or exploit existing mathematical theories about matter or forces or space. But what are the guiding principles beyond this basic rule? One that my colleagues and I favor is that models be as economical and predictive as possible. A model with too many moving pieces won't explain anything. A model that is broad enough to accommodate any potential outcome isn't science. Only models that make sufficiently specific predictions to be tested and distinguished from other ideas might ultimately prove interesting. An additional desirable, though not essential, feature is that its elements connect to existing models. An example would be a dark matter candidate that occurs anyway in models that have been suggested to underlie the standard model of ordinary matter. Although such a tie-in isn't guaranteed, such connections are promising in that they avoid additional speculations about an entirely new sector of particles and forces. Finally, and most essentially, models should be consistent with all known experimental and observational results. any single contradiction suffices to rule a model out. These criteria apply to all models, including the most popular dark matter models that I'll now discuss. WIMPs. WIMPs have been the reigning dark matter paradigm among members of the physics and astrophysics communities for several decades. WIMP is the acronym for Weakly Interacting Massive Particle. The word weak is not a reference to the weak nuclear force. Most WIMP candidates interact even more weakly than the standard model's weakly interacting neutrinos. But the interactions are indeed feeble in the sense that dark matter does not scatter a lot, if at all, as it traverses the universe. Moreover, WIMP candidates have mass of about the weak scale, which is, roughly speaking, the mass of the recently discovered Higgs particle, accessible at the energy that experiments at the Large Hadron Collider currently explore. To be clear, the Higgs boson is not stable and does have interactions. It is certainly not what dark matter is made of. But other particles with about the same mass might be. If true, not only would dark matter literally be right under our noses, but its identity could prove to be so too, at least for LHC experimentalists. Support for the WIMP hypothesis is based on a remarkable observation that might be a coincidence or might be a clue to the nature of dark matter. If a stable particle exists with mass comparable to that of the recently discovered Higgs boson, the amount of energy carried by such particles that survive in the universe today would be about right to account for the energy carried by the universe's dark matter. The calculation that demonstrates that particles with this mass are suitable dark matter candidates proceeds from the following observation. As the universe evolved and its temperature decreased, heavier particles that were abundant in the hot early universe became much more dispersed. This is because as the temperature dropped, heavy particles annihilated with heavy antiparticles, the equal mass particles with which particles can annihilate, so that both of them disappeared. But the reverse process, where they get created, no longer occurred at any significant rate because the energy wasn't sufficient to make them. The consequence was that the number density of heavy particles decreased as the universe cooled. If particles had kept to their thermal distribution, the number of them that should be around at a particular temperature, as the temperature dropped, heavy particles would have essentially all annihilated with each other. However, because of the decreasing abundance of heavy particles, the above picture is overly simple. In order to annihilate, particles and antiparticles have to first find each other. But as their number decreased and they became more diffuse, this meeting became less likely. As a consequence, particles annihilated less efficiently as the universe grew older and cooler. The result is that substantially more particles remain today than a naive application of thermodynamics would suggest. At some point, both particles and antiparticles became so dilute that they just couldn't find and eliminate each other. How many particles remain depends on the mass and the interactions of the putative dark matter candidate. The intriguing and remarkable conclusion from the appropriate calculations is that stable particles with roughly the Higgs boson's mass happen to be left with about the right abundance to be the dark matter. We don't yet know if the numbers work out exactly. We will need to know the detailed particle properties to find out. But the fortuitous, albeit rough, agreement between numbers associated with what on the surface appear to be two entirely different phenomena is intriguing, and might well be an indication that weak-scale physics accounts for the dark matter in the universe. This observation has led many physicists to suspect dark matter is indeed composed of WIMP particles, as these candidates are known. WIMPs have the advantage that because of their connection to standard model physics, they are more readily testable than some of the alternative dark matter candidates. WIMP dark matter doesn't interact only via gravity. It also has small non-gravitational interactions with standard model particles. Even if those interactions are small, they could still be big enough for very sensitive experiments to record their influence in the so-called direct detection experiments described in the next chapter. But WIMP searches have so far come up empty-handed. Well, that's not entirely true. Tantalizing hints of detection emerge on a regular basis, but no one is convinced that any of these truly represent dark matter discovery, as opposed to a statistical fluctuation, some problem with a detecting device, or a misunderstanding of astrophysical backgrounds that can mimic the searched-for effect. The evidence is certainly not yet overwhelming. Yet despite the lack of detection, Many scientists just like the idea and still think the coincidence of scales involved in particle physics and dark matter is too good to be accidental. As if this were not overly sanguine enough, many go further and believe in very specific WIMP models, such as those associated with supersymmetry, a theory proposing that for every known particle, there is an as-yet unseen supersymmetric partner with the same mass and charges. Given that neither supersymmetric particles nor WIMPs have yet been discovered, even some of the most die-hard supporters have begun to admit some degree of doubt. As for me, I try to assess the situation as it is at any given point. At a wedding I recently attended, the priest was unusually curious about physics and kept asking me what my gut feeling was for what dark matter would turn out to be. I repeatedly disappointed him by saying I'll let nature decide. As a model builder, I have always had less faith in supersymmetry addressing problems about the Higgs mass, even before the LHC's more recent results, because I knew only too well how challenging it is to make all the pieces fit together. I wouldn't have ruled out supersymmetry, and I still don't. That's what experiments are for. But I also wouldn't have said that it was definitely or even likely to be correct. Similarly, I keep an open mind about dark matter candidates. What I told the priest was true. I don't have a favorite. I try to make testable models because that's the only way we will ultimately learn the answer. As with supersymmetry, the absence of experimental support for WIMPs is making even those who were formerly firmly in the WIMP camp question their confidence that they are on the right track. It is certainly fair, in the absence of any experimental support, to consider some promising alternatives. I don't know which, if any of them, are realized in the world, but perhaps some other seeming coincidence of nature constitutes the better clue. Asymmetric dark matter. One of the most interesting alternatives to WIMP dark matter has various names in the literature, but is most commonly referred to as asymmetric dark matter. Models that contain dark matter of this type address another remarkable coincidence that might be accidental or might give us an insight into the nature of dark matter. The amount of dark matter and the amount of ordinary matter are surprisingly comparable. I recognize that when you first heard that dark matter carries 5 times the energy of ordinary matter, you might have concluded the opposite, that dark matter overwhelms the energy carried by ordinary matter. However, viewed over the range of possibilities, their energy densities are remarkably similar. The amount of dark matter could have been 700 trillion times more or a Google times less than that of ordinary matter. The evolution of the universe would of course have been staggeringly different in either of those cases, but nonetheless these ratios were all possibilities. Yet the universe contains roughly the same amount of ordinary matter as dark matter. To say it another way, you can readily see all the slices of the cosmic pie describing the energy carried by dark energy, dark matter, and ordinary matter. There is no slice that you would consider to be a crumb or the entire pie. They are all slices, albeit ones that would lead to different amounts of weight gain if it were indeed a real pie. Without an underlying reason, this is a remarkable coincidence. In fairness, it is not surprising that the contributions we can observe have comparable sizes. Too small a contribution and a component would not be detectable. The interesting observation is that several components have high enough energy density to contribute comparable amounts today. In principle, one contribution might have been a trillion times bigger than the others, so that the smaller ones were never observed. But that is not the case. Dark matter and ordinary matter have remarkably similar energy densities. In asymmetric dark matter models, the similarity in energy densities between ordinary matter and dark matter is not a coincidence. It is a prediction. The coincidence addressed by these models is different than the one that WIMP models are supposed to address, which is the amount of energy density left in dark matter after it has partially annihilated. We don't know which of these coincidences, if either, is truly a clue to advancing our understanding, but both types of models are compelling enough to be worth considering and might even turn out to be right. In the early 1990s, a number of physicists, including David B. Kaplan, currently director of the Institute for Nuclear Theory at the University of Washington in Seattle, considered this possibility. The idea was revived to account for more recent cosmological measurements in the late 2000s by another David Kaplan, who had formerly been a student at Washington, along with the physicists Marcus Luthi and Catherine Zurek. Many other physicists, including me, have worked on this type of model as well. So, what is the idea? To understand the scenario and its motivation, let's take a step back for a moment to reflect on ordinary matter. As alluded to in Chapter 3, the unidentified dark matter is not the only form of matter to present a mystery. Familiar ordinary matter does too, specifically the amount of it we find in the universe today. The energy of most ordinary matter lies in protons and neutrons, which are a form of baryon, matter that is ultimately composed of elementary particles called quarks. Had ordinary matter, consisting mostly of baryons, been distributed according to the simplest early universe scenario, annihilating away as the universe cooled, it would have far lower density than that which we currently observe. A critical feature for our universe and ourselves is that in contrast to standard thermal expectations, ordinary matter sticks around and survives in sufficient quantities to create animals and cities and stars. This is possible only because matter dominates over antimatter. There is a matter-antimatter asymmetry. If the amounts had always been equal, matter and antimatter would have found each other, annihilated, and disappeared. Clearly, at some point in the universe's evolution, the amount of matter surpassed the amount of antimatter. Without such an excess, too much of the matter would be gone by now. But we don't yet know how this occurred. Matter-antimatter asymmetry happened only with some special interactions and conditions in the early universe. Some process must have gone out of thermal equilibrium, proceeding too slowly to keep up with the universe's expansion, or else matter and antimatter particles would be created in equal numbers. Moreover, symmetries that might have seemed natural can't apply when the excess matter gets created. We don't know what gave rise to either the symmetry breaking or the departure from thermal equilibrium, though there are suggestions for both in the context of grand unified theories, models of leptons, particles like electrons and neutrinos that don't experience the strong interactions, and supersymmetry. No one will know which, if any, of these models is right until someone finds observational evidence. Unfortunately, many of these scenarios don't have readily observable consequences. Even so, we can be confident that at some point, a process called baryogenesis occurred, in which an excess of matter over antimatter, a matter-antimatter asymmetry, gets created. Without baryogenesis, none of us would be here to tell even this partial tale. Asymmetric dark matter models suggest that since the dark matter energy density is so similar to that of ordinary matter, maybe dark matter too got created in a related process involving a dark matter-dark antimatter asymmetry. Matthew Buckley, who was a Caltech postdoctoral fellow when we worked on this topic, and I, labeled this process exogenesis, playing with the idea of dark matter as the unknown quantity, X. The truly compelling aspect of any of these models is that not only do they allow for dark matter creation in analogy to ordinary matter, the two are actually related in the most interesting examples. If dark matter and ordinary matter have some form of interaction, even a rather feeble one, and perhaps one that was stronger earlier on, the energy density of ordinary matter and dark matter should be comparable. This is the strongest motivation for believing these models might turn out to be correct. Axions. WIMP and asymmetric dark matter models are both general paradigms. WIMP-type models involve a weak-scale, stable particle, and asymmetric dark matter models suggest an asymmetry of dark matter over anti-dark matter. Both ideas encompass a wide variety of implementations that might include distinguishing particles and interactions. Axion models deal with a more restrictive scenario. An axion appears only in models associated with a very specific issue in particle physics, known as the strong CP problem, where C stands for charge and P stands for parity. C negative, or charge conservation, says that interactions of positively and negatively charged particles are closely related. P negative, or parity symmetry, says that no physical laws should distinguish left from right, so that, for example, particles spinning to the left and spinning to the right should have identical interactions. Yet not only do nature's interactions independently violate C and P, they also violate the combination together. That is to say, the violations in C and P don't compensate each other. However, for yet unknown reasons, CP violation, as the combination of C and P symmetries is known, happens only in some processes. The absence of an explanation for why CP should restrict interactions in some cases but not in others within the context of standard model physics, is known as the strong CP problem. Axions feature in a proposed solution to this conundrum. I mention all this for completeness. Without some background in particle physics or an entire book on the subject, I'm aware that these ideas can be difficult to grasp. Fortunately, to understand the axion's cosmological implications and its role as a potential dark matter candidate, you don't need to follow the particle physics specifics. The cosmological predictions depend only on an axion being extremely light and having extremely weak interactions. You might think such features would render axions harmless. In fact, that is what most physicists did think initially. But in a remarkable paper, the particle theorists John Preskill, Frank Wilczek, and Mark Wise explained why this is not necessarily the case. These authors showed that axions are so weakly interacting and so light that the number of axions wouldn't affect the energy of the early universe. No physical process determined how many of them should be around. Their presence would not have affected the universe's evolution after it cooled sufficiently. Because of the axion density's irrelevance early on, at the time when axions do finally make a difference, their number is very unlikely to be the one the universe would favor, the number that minimizes energy, for example. The universe would therefore then find itself with a large number of axions in an enormous condensate, so many that even though the axion is very light, the axion condensate's energy is large. In a surprising turn, axions cannot interact too weakly, or the universe would have more energy than is allowed. The above considerations restrict the allowed range of axions' interactions. But turning this observation on its side, if the interactions are weak, but not too weak, axions might carry a large energy density, just not necessarily so large as to contradict observations. In fact, if the interaction strength is just right, dark matter could be composed of axions that carry precisely the measured dark matter energy density. Axions have a mass that is very different from either of the dark matter candidates described previously. Whereas both the other suggestions involve dark matter particles with mass near the weak scale, or maybe 100 times less, axion scenarios involve extremely light particles with mass at least a billion times smaller. Furthermore, axions interact very differently from the other dark matter candidates. The combination of cosmological and astrophysical constraints place axion models in a very narrow window of permissible masses and interaction strengths. The interactions can't be too weak, or there would be too much axion energy density. But they also can't be too strong, or we would have seen axions through direct production in particle experiments or in stars. That's because axions that interact sufficiently strongly would be produced in stars and could thereby cool them down. The observed rate of supernova cooling shows no sign of non-standard contributions and thus limits the strength with which axions can interact. Theoretically, in light of the constraints, I find axion models a little odd in that the window of interactions that is experimentally permitted is pretty random with no clear relation to any other physical processes. I'm a little doubtful that experiments searching for axions will find a positive result, but many of my colleagues are more optimistic. Ongoing searches for axions involve their admittedly very feeble interaction with light. Axion detectors placed in huge magnetic fields look for measurable radiation that the axion's interaction with a magnetic field would produce. Only time and such experiments will tell whether or not axions exist in nature, and if they do, whether they indeed constitute the dark matter. Neutrinos. A common aspect of all the models I've presented is that they include some connection between ordinary matter and dark matter, hinted at either by the coincidence of mass scales for WIMPs, by the proximity of energy densities for ADM models, or by a proposed solution to the strong CP problem in the case of axions. Axion models were hypothesized for a particular physics reason, but might nonetheless account for dark matter. WIMPs, too, were sometimes part of a proposed particle physics scenario, such as supersymmetry. Asymmetric dark matter models might also exist in the framework of existing theories, but, despite the interactions between dark matter and ordinary matter, usually an asymmetric dark matter candidate is an extraneous addition to the theory. However, it might well be that dark matter, or at least some of it, interacts purely gravitationally. Dark matter might also have some of its own forces and interactions not experienced by our matter. But before proposing the existence of an independent dark matter sector, physicists first considered whether any type of ordinary matter might itself have the properties that could allow it to be the dark matter. The question was whether anything in the Standard Model, or something that was composed of Standard Model particles, could be a suitable dark matter candidate, even without the inclusion of additional particles. One of the earliest such suggestions concerned a type of elementary particle called a neutrino. In the radioactive process known as beta decay, neutrons decay to protons and electrons and neutrinos, technically to their antiparticles, known as antineutrinos. Neutrinos are particles that, like electrons and their heavier counterparts known as muons and taus, don't experience the strong nuclear force. Also, they carry zero electric charge, so they don't directly experience electromagnetism either. One of the most interesting properties of neutrinos is that, aside from gravity, which all particles experience, albeit at an extremely tiny level, they interact directly only through the weak force. The other is that they are known to be very light, at least a million times lighter than an electron. Because they interact so feebly, neutrinos originally seemed like promising dark matter candidates. But by now, that hope has been quashed for several reasons. The neutrinos of the Standard Model interact via the weak nuclear force. But for anything sufficiently light that has weak force interactions, the direct detection experiments discussed in the next chapter, which have so far come up empty-handed, would have already seen something. On top of that, ordinary neutrinos that we know to exist can't be the dark matter, since their energy density is far too small. For dark matter's energy to be matched by that of neutrinos, neutrinos would have to be much heavier. In fact, light neutrinos would be a form of hot dark matter, which travels at nearly the speed of light. Hot dark matter would wash out structure on scales smaller than a supercluster. Yet we observe galaxies and galaxy clusters, so this would be a problem. So neutrinos don't work in the context of the Standard Model of particle physics. Physicists subsequently considered modifications to the Standard Model that also didn't work. Particles that interact like neutrinos, even modified versions of neutrinos, don't give rise to the nice story of structure formation that was outlined in Chapter 5. In principle, hot dark matter could still be okay if the smaller structures that we know to exist weren't formed directly but had formed from the fragmentation of bigger ones. But this scenario can be worked out numerically, and the predictions don't match observations. So despite the occasional hints of new light neutrinos and the appearance of headlines about dark matter neutrinos, neutrinos really aren't the dark matter. Neutrinos can at best account for a small fraction of the existing dark matter density. This is why physicists concentrate their attention on cold dark matter scenarios, which suggest more slowly moving dark matter candidates, which are usually heavier. Hot dark matter scenarios, what you get when you have light and very fast-moving particles, such as neutrinos, are ruled out. Machos. Finally, let's consider the superficially more likely possibility that dark matter isn't composed of novel elementary particles, and instead composed of non-burning and hence non-light-emitting, non-reflective macroscopic structures. We wouldn't see these objects for the same reason we don't see in a dark room. It's not that the stuff around you doesn't interact with light at some level, it's just that there isn't enough light around for you to see. Before accepting the existence of dark matter, most anyone, scientifically inclined or not, would want to know why this seemingly obvious possibility isn't true. Dark objects like these are known collectively as MACHOs, an acronym for Massive Compact Halo Objects, their role as an alternative to WIMPs being the not-so-subtle reason behind the name. Since MACHOs emit little or no detectable light, they could appear to be hidden and dark even though they are composed of ordinary matter. MACHO candidates include black holes, neutron stars, and brown dwarfs. As introduced earlier, black holes are very tight, gravitationally bound states of matter that don't emit or reflect light. Neutron stars, possibly produced in supernova collapse, are the remnants of massive stars that don't have quite enough matter to become black holes, but instead condense into a state with an extremely dense neutron core. Brown dwarfs are objects that are bigger than Jupiter, but smaller than stars, so they couldn't ignite via nuclear fusion, but instead heat up only through their gravitational contraction. The above astrophysical objects certainly seem like reasonable possibilities, but even before more recent observations severely restricted the possibility, machos were considered unlikely. You might recall from Chapter 4 that one of the early tests of the standard Big Bang scenario was the creation of nuclei in the early universe, the process known as primordial nucleosynthesis. But that scenario works only for some definite range of values for the energy density in ordinary matter. Most macho models contain too much ordinary matter to yield the correct nuclei abundance predictions. On top of that, even if ordinary matter formed these compact objects, understanding how they ended up in the halo rather than in the galactic disk poses another important challenge. Even so, astrophysicists kept an open mind. Dark matter is an extraordinary proposal, so it's worth ensuring that every conventional explanation is ruled out. In the 1990s, physicists searched for machos through a process known as microlensing. According to this beautiful and subtle idea, machos moving through space occasionally pass in front of a star. Because light rays bend around a macho or any other massive object, it acts as a lens whose gravitational influence temporarily amplifies the light from the star, making it appear brighter before it returns to normal. Of course, this has to happen on a timescale that is short enough to be observed, and the change in magnitude has to be a big enough effect to be detected. But astronomers using this method could show that machos in the range between about a third the mass of the moon to about 100 times the mass of the sun cannot be the dark matter, thereby ruling out many macho candidates. Though macho searches ruled out neutron stars and white dwarfs, black holes in a narrow mass window remained a possibility. Aside from the lack of theoretical reasons to believe there would be the right amount of black holes in any given mass range, the gravitational disruptions caused by black holes, as well as the duration of a black hole's existence, do nonetheless place further limits. This is because black holes that are too small would have already decayed away by emitting photons in a process known as Hawking radiation, named after the physicist Stephen Hawking, who first proposed it. Whereas those that are too big would have observable effects that haven't been seen. These include disruptions of binary systems, scattering that can heat up and widen the plane of the Milky Way, limitations on black holes accreting other matter and radiating, and the effect of gravity waves associated with black holes on the precisely measured pulsar timing. Putting the constraints together might permit black hole masses from about a millionth of a lunar mass to a lunar mass, but black holes outside this mass range are ruled out. Detailed measurements of neutron star properties might rule out even this limited range. Even if a very small window for black hole masses does persist, it would be hard to fathom why only black holes in this one particular mass range would be created and would have survived in sufficient quantity. It's fair to consider the possibility, but based on nucleosynthesis and model-building constraints, black holes, especially ones that were created only by ordinary matter, are extremely unlikely to be the dark matter. What to do? The above models contain the most commonly discussed candidates for dark matter, the ones that most physicists think of as reasonable possibilities, but they are almost certainly not the only options. Though some of these ideas are still promising, we have good reason to be skeptical of any specific model or property until it is experimentally confirmed. On the other hand, we can be very confident that dark matter exists, even if we don't yet know what it is. This is presently a good time for both theorists and experimenters to reassess and to try to consider a more complete range of options. Most of them will involve different types of search strategies. Alternative models will be useful in planning these out. But before getting to some newer ideas, I'll first review some of the existing dark matter search strategies in order to more knowledgeably assess the current situation. We'll see that the abundant data in astrophysics, coupled with the lack of detection of previously proposed models, gives experimenters and observers good reason to look beyond these older and more developed dark matter searches. Chapter 17. How to See in the Dark. The Brown University professor Richard Gaitskell, a principal investigator and co-spokesperson of LUX, a major dark matter detection experiment, spoke at Harvard in December 2013. In the colloquium he gave to the many rapt physics department members in attendance, He gleefully described how he and his collaborators hadn't yet discovered dark matter. The measure of his experiment's success was, curiously enough, that it had ruled out many of the dark matter candidates that a large class of models and even some now spurious experimental results had suggested. Yet despite the disappointing physics news that dark matter had not yet been found by his or any other experiment, Gaitskell was justifiably elated. The very challenging experiment he and others had built had worked as well as he had hoped. It wasn't his fault that nature hadn't cooperated and provided a dark matter candidate with a mass and interaction strength that his experiment could find. This was only the first set of results from the Lux experiment, which continues to run and collect more data, yet it had overtaken the results from the older, more well-established experiments right out of the gate. Gaitskell and his collaborators had created such a clean environment that the experiment's very first results were sufficiently trustworthy to supersede older findings. In a setting where radioactivity from a rogue experimentalist's misplaced fingerprint can contribute billions of times more signal than the sought-after feeble imprint of a dark matter particle, Gaitskell's experiment had done spectacularly well. The clean and reliable data the experiment had collected definitively established that his apparatus did precisely what it had been designed to do, extremely sensitive searches and a trustworthy rejection of any misleading signals. Lots of data gets collected through the latest technology today, and not all of it is about people's consumer preferences. Data currently being amassed will lead to advances in particle physics, astronomy, and cosmology, as well as other fields of science. Although no experiment has decisively discovered dark matter, many experiments have presented tantalizing results. Sometimes an experiment like Gaitskell's comes along and rules out many of the tantalizing possibilities that previous experiments with less decisive measurements had suggested. His and other experiments continue their searches in the hopes that they will soon find a more robust signal that will represent a true discovery. However, the search for dark matter is a daunting task. Because gravity is such a weak force, the searches for the particles that compose dark matter need to invoke precisely those interactions that we don't yet know that dark matter experiences. If dark matter interacts solely gravitationally, or via new forces not experienced by ordinary matter, conventional dark matter searches will never find it. Even if standard model forces do act on dark matter, we still can't be sure that the interactions are strong enough for current experiments to detect. Today's searches rely on a leap of faith that dark matter, despite its near invisibility, has interactions that are sufficiently substantial for detectors built from ordinary matter to register. This is based partially on wishful thinking, but optimism is also rooted in the implications of the WIMP models discussed in the previous chapter. Most WIMP dark matter candidates should interact with standard model particles a tiny bit, small indeed, but at rates that could potentially be observable with the very precise experiments now in operation. Searches have reached the point where most WIMP models will be confirmed or ruled out once these experiments present their final results. When investigating alternative dark matter models in the chapters that follow, I'll present some of their very different observational implications. But this chapter's focus is WIMP dark matter and the three favored approaches for seeking it. Figure 36 on the enhancement contains a graph to help illustrate this. Dark matter is elusive, but experimenters have been intrepid in their search for its subtle, observable consequences. Direct detection experiments. The first class of experiments that look for WIMPs fall into the category of direct detection. Direct detection experiments involve enormous, extremely sensitive apparatuses on Earth whose large detection volume is designed to compensate for dark matter's, at best, minuscule interaction strength. The idea behind these searches is that dark matter should travel through the material of a detector until it hits a nucleus. The interaction would then provide a small amount of recoil heat or energy that can in principle be measured either with a very cold detector or with a very sensitive material that is designed to absorb and record the tiny heat that might be deposited. If a dark matter particle passes through a direct detection apparatus and hits and subtly ricochets off a nucleus, the experiment might record the tiny change in energy that would be the sole potentially measurable evidence of its passage. Although the chance of any individual interaction is very small, the probability of success improves with larger size and better sensitivity, which is why the experiments are so big. Cryogenic detectors are very cold devices with crystal absorbers, such as germanium. They respond to the small amount of heat by using squids, superconducting quantum interference devices, which are built into the detector. These devices lose superconductivity and register a potential dark matter event if even a small amount of energy hits the very cold superconducting material that is built into it. Experiments in this category include the Cryogenic Dark Matter Search, CDMS, the Cryogenic Rare Event Search with Superconducting Thermometers, CREST, and the Expérience pour détecter les WIMPs en site souterrain, which is French for Experiment to Detect WIMPs in an Underground Site, Edelweiss. The names are a handful, but most physicists use only the more tractable acronyms. Cryogenic detectors are not the only type of detector. The other type, which is rapidly increasing in importance, employs noble liquids. Even though dark matter doesn't directly interact with light, the energy added to an atom of xenon or argon when hit by a dark matter particle can potentially generate a flash of characteristic scintillation. Experiments of this sort include the xenon-based experiments Xenon 100 and LUX, the large underground xenon detector, the experiment I mentioned above, as well as the argon-based detectors named Zeppelin, Deep, Warp, Darkside, and ARDM. Both Xenon and LUX will have bigger and better upgrades in the coming years, Xenon 1T and the LUX-Zeppelin collaboration. To give an idea of the progress, the 100 in the original Xenon name was a rough measure of kilograms, whereas 1T stands for 1 ton. LUX-Zeppelin will be even bigger, with a 5-ton fiducial volume, which is the region used for dark matter detection. Both cryogenic and noble gas detectors are designed to record the tiny energy a dark matter particle might deposit. However, impressive as this may be, detecting a small change in energy won't suffice to establish that a dark matter particle has passed through. Experimenters also need to establish that they have recorded the desired signal and not just background radiation, which also can deposit small amounts of energy that might mimic dark matter and that interacts much more strongly with ordinary matter than dark matter ever could. This is tough. Radiation, from the perspective of a sensitive dark matter detection apparatus, is everywhere. Cosmic ray muons, heavier partners of electrons, can hit rock and create a splash of particles, as can some neutrons that mimic dark matter. Even making reasonably optimistic assumptions about the mass and interaction strength of the dark matter particles, background electromagnetic events dominate over the signal by at least a factor of 1,000, and this estimate doesn't take into account all the primordial and man-made radioactive substances that are present in the air, the environment, and the detector. The scientists who design these apparatuses know this all too well. The name of the game for astrophysicists and dark matter experimenters is shielding and discrimination. In order to protect their detector from dangerous radiation and distinguish potential dark matter events from uninteresting radiation scattering in the detectors, experimenters look for dark matter deep underground in mines or below mountains. Cosmic rays should then hit the rock surrounding a sufficiently buried detector instead of the detector itself. Most of the radiation will be screened, whereas dark matter, which has much weaker interaction strength, will make it to the detector unimpeded. Fortunately, plenty of mines and tunnels that have been built for commercial purposes are available to house such experiments. Mines exist in part because, as noted earlier, heavy elements sink to the center of the Earth, but some fraction occasionally rises up in ore deposits underground. The DAMA experiment, along with experiments called Xenoid 10 and the bigger Xenoid 100, as well as CREST, a detector that uses tungsten, takes place in the Gran Sasso National Laboratory, situated in a tunnel in Italy about 1,400 meters underground. A 1,500-meter-deep cavern in the Homestake Mine in South Dakota, originally built for gold excavation, is home to the LUX experiment. The Homestake Mine is famous in physics circles as the location where another impressive detection, neutrinos from the sun, took place and provided the first real clue that neutrinos had non-zero masses. The CDMS experiment is in the Sudan mine that is located about 750 meters underground. The Sudbury mine in Ontario, Canada, the mine created to dig up the metals concentrated in that region by an enormous asteroid that hit about 2 billion years ago, is home to several dark matter experiments too. Still, All that rock above the mines and tunnels is not enough to guarantee that the detectors are radiation-free. The experiments further protect the detectors in a variety of ways. The shield I find most amusing is old lead taken from a sunken French galleon. Lead is a dense absorbing material, and old lead has already rid itself of whatever radiation it initially contained, so it is effective at absorbing radiation without providing new sources of its own. Other, more technologically advanced shielding comes, for example, from polyethylene that lights up if something interacts too strongly to be dark matter. In the noble liquid detectors, such as those using xenon, the detector itself functions as a shield. The absorbing region of these xenon detectors is so large that the experimenters omit the outer region, which is used only to block radioactive backgrounds when they record the signal that comes solely from the inner region. Discrimination is important, too. Particle physicists use a different term, particle identification, particle ID, for this requirement. Maybe the particle physics term is more PC, though ID requirements are politically loaded these days as well. Whatever the name, discrimination, as opposed to shielding, is about distinguishing the electromagnetic radiation that nonetheless makes it through from potential dark matter candidates. By measuring both ionization and the initial scintillation, experimenters can distinguish signal from background radiation. The DAMA experiment, a scintillation experiment located in the Gran Sasso National Laboratory in Italy, has been reporting a signal for some time now. However, because the experiment lacks discrimination between signal and background, relying solely on timing information, and because no other experiment has reproduced the result, most physicists remain skeptical about the signal's authenticity. Other experiments also have recorded potential signals, but with very few events, and those only at low energies. There is good reason to be suspicious of these results, too. You will recall that the detectors measure recoil energy. When that energy is too small, the detector can't record it, since it's below the sensitivity of the apparatus. The lowest energy events are closest to the difficult-to-access low-energy boundary. So skepticism about any potential low-energy signal is warranted until more data arrive or some other experiment confirms the potential observations. Indirect detection. Direct detection experiments that look for dark matter that passes through Earth might succeed in their mission and discover dark matter particles, but another promising search strategy is to look for the signal that would arise if dark matter particles annihilate with dark matter antiparticles, or the same type of particle when it can annihilate with itself, transforming the dark matter particle's energy into other, hopefully visible, types of matter. Dark matter annihilation probably doesn't happen very often, since dark matter is so dilute, but this doesn't mean that it doesn't happen at all. It depends on what the nature of dark matter turns out to be. If and when annihilations occur, experiments on Earth or in space might find the particles that emerged from the annihilation in what is known as indirect detection. Such searches look for the particles that were created after the annihilating dark matter particles disappeared. If we are lucky, those emerging particles will include standard model particles and antiparticles, such as electrons and their antiparticles, positrons, or pairs of photons, all of which detectors on Earth and in space could potentially observe. Antiparticle and photon signals are the most promising search targets associated with the indirect detection of dark matter because of the rarity of antiparticles in the cosmos. Photons can be useful too, since photons originating from the annihilation of dark matter will have a different energy and spatial distribution from photons created by astrophysical backgrounds. Most of the instruments that search for these standard model products of dark matter annihilation weren't originally designed as dark matter detectors. The primary goal of the majority of telescopes and detectors that are out in space or on the ground is to record light and particles from objects in the sky. The objective is a better understanding of the stars, pulsars, and other objects, which to a dark matter experimentalist are the astrophysical background that might mimic a dark matter signal. Viewed differently, this similarity of particles emitted by astrophysical background sources and putative dark matter annihilations tells us that the observations of existing telescopes can potentially tell us about dark matter, too. If astrophysicists understand the more conventional sources of such particles, they can distinguish them from an excess due to dark matter. Despite potential ambiguities in interpretation, indirect dark matter searches could succeed if conventional sources are sufficiently well understood to guarantee that they wouldn't suffice to account for what might be found. One such experiment exists on the International Space Station. The Nobel Prize winner Sam Ting from MIT had the clever idea of putting a particle detector there to look for positrons and antiprotons. The Alpha Magnetic Spectrometer, AMS, is essentially a particle detector in space. It has extended the search that the Italian-led PAMELA satellite, the pretty name is also an acronym, which first reported results in 2013, had already done. Although the data had looked intriguing at first, dark matter as an explanation is now strongly disfavored because, among other things, the PAMELA and AMS signals would require so much dark matter in the early universe that its distorting effects on the microwave background should have been seen by the Planck satellite. The initially surprising outcome now seems to be merely an indication that astrophysicists have a lot to learn about astrophysical sources, such as pulsars. As long as conventional sources stand a chance of explaining the signal, no convincing argument for dark matter can be made. Dark matter might also annihilate into quarks and antiquarks, or into gluons, particles that interact via the strong nuclear force. In fact, most WIMP-type models predict this to be the most probable standard model outcome. The astrophysical backgrounds for the most obvious search target, antiprotons, is big, but those for low-energy antideuterons, which are very weakly bound states of antiprotons and antineutrons, are much lower. Experiments might have a chance of discovering dark matter through their annihilations into these low-energy states. The balloon-based experiment GAPS, scheduled to launch from Antarctica by 2019, will look for this signal. The uncharged particles called neutrinos that interact only via the weak force could also help with indirect dark matter detection. Dark matter might get trapped in the center of the Sun or the Earth, increasing the dark matter density over its usual value and enhancing the probability of annihilation. The only particles that could escape and potentially be detected would then be neutrinos, since, unlike other particles, they are too weakly interacting to be blocked from escaping by their interactions. Detectors on the ground, named Amanda, IceCube, and Antares, are looking for these high-energy neutrinos. Other ground-based detectors look for high-energy photons, electrons, and positrons. HESS, the High-Energy Stereoscopic System, located in Namibia, and VERITAS, the Very Energetic Radiation Imaging Telescope Array System in Arizona, are large arrays of telescopes on Earth that look for high-energy photons from the center of the galaxy. The next-generation Very High-Energy Gamma Ray Observatory, the Cherenkov Telescope Array, promises to be even more sensitive. But probably the most important indirect detection searches in the last couple of years have been performed by the telescopes on the Fermi Gamma Ray Space Observatory, informally known as Fermi, named after the great Italian physicist for whom fermions are also named. The Fermi Observatory sits on a satellite that was launched early in 2008, orbiting the sky every 95 minutes at a height of 550 kilometers above the Earth. Other photon detectors that sit on Earth have the advantage that they can be much bigger than a satellite in the sky. But the very precise instruments on the Fermi satellite have better energy resolution and directional information, are sensitive to photons with lower energies, and have a much wider field of view. The Fermi satellite has been the source of a lot of interesting speculation of late about dark matter. Several hints of signals have emerged since it began operation, none of which are decisive, but all of which have led to interesting insights into what dark matter might be. The strongest signal at this time is one that the physicist Dan Hooper from Fermilab, the Fermi National Accelerator Laboratory located in Batavia, Illinois, near Chicago, has been advocating. He and his collaborators observed that a careful study of the diffuse photon emission near the galactic center shows an excess over what is expected from astrophysical backgrounds. As with the earlier excess positron detection, the data fairly decisively show an excess over expectations. The question, again, is whether the missing ingredient is some neglected astrophysical source or something truly exciting, like dark matter. Astronomers are still at work trying to determine the answer. As of now, neither explanation seems entirely straightforward or convincing. Another signal that has emerged in photons and has no known explanation from conventional astrophysical sources comes in the form of an X-ray line at a few kilo electron volts, about a hundredth of the energy carried by an electron. The peculiar feature of the observation is that it is a line, which means the excess photons occur at a definitive energy with very little energy spread. Mind you,